This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Natalia Melman Petrozella, and from the BBC, this is Extreme, Peak Danger.
The most beautiful mountain in the world.
If you die on the mountain, you stay on the mountain.
This is the story of what happened when 11 climbers died on one of the world's deadliest mountains, K2. And of the risks we'll take to feel truly alive.
If I tell all the details, you won't believe it anymore.
Extreme, Peak Danger. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Krupa Party, and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Hello, thank you for being with us on what really feels like a very spring-like morning, at least here in London. I do hope the sun is shining where you are too. Coming up on the programme, we will be speaking to the face of 1966, none other than Twiggy. This week sees the release of a new docufilm about the supermodel's life, directed by Sadie Frost. It's the story of her rise from a working-class family in the north of London to becoming one of the most famous teenagers in the world, and of course, much, much more. Stay with us for that. Also, the writer Elizabeth Levette on her new film, Thank You for Calling the Lesbian Line, which gathers logbooks of recorded calls from women who phoned the line in the 1990s. And this is what we want to hear from you about. Tell us about a time when someone, an entire stranger to you, has been on the end of the line to support you. In the age of the internet, where answers are shot out in a matter of seconds, how has picking up that phone to share a worry or seek advice helped you? Hearing a voice and not knowing or seeing each other in the slightest, what difference does that make? Is there still a role for telephone lines, or telephone helplines rather? You can text the programme. The number is 84844. Texts will be charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we are at BBC Women's Hour. That's X and Instagram. And you can email us through our website. And of course, you can WhatsApp. Audio note us now. That number is 03700 100 444. All of our terms and conditions can be found on our website. And if you or someone you know has suffered a trauma, what difference would it make to have pocket-sized cards that told your health worker what you had gone through and what additional support you might need to access a healthcare service? Now, after a successful trial, we learn more about the calls for trauma cards to be introduced countrywide. So all of that coming up. But let's start with last night, the biggest night in film, the Oscars, the independent film Anora, made for just $5 million, cleaned up, winning five awards, including Best Picture and Best Actress for Mikey Madison, a 25-year-old relative unknown who was, in fact, on our programme just last month. Well, to give us all the news and highlights, film journalist Karen Krizanovic joins me now. Welcome, Karen.
Good morning.
Well, talk us through the key takeaways from last night.
Oh, well, it was a big night. I mean, Mikey Madison did win the BAFTA when we all expected Demi Moore to take Best Actress Oscar. And she was told, now the big deal about Demi Moore is that she was told 30 years ago she'll never amount to anything. She's just a popcorn actress. And we were hoping that that would be different. But wonderful news for Mikey Madison, who is pretty much sweeping the boards with her performance in the fabulous Anora, which out of six nominations took five gongs. Not too bad.
And Demi was also on Woman's Hour. Well, let's talk about Anora, because it's cleaned up, like I said.
It has.
It's done exceptionally well. Why do you think that has been?
Well, it's a fresh story. I mean, it's about a sex worker, and it's about she accidentally marries a Russian oligarch's son, who he's very wealthy, and it's just crazy, and you can't really tell if they're in love or not. But the Russian oligarch decides that his son cannot be married to a sex worker, and so the heavies fly over to break up the wedding, and that's basically the story. Now, Sean Baker not only produced it, so he got the Best Picture gong. He wrote it, he edited it, and he also I'm blanking now, but and then she of course won the lead. But this is it's a small movie. It's made for $6 million. He wrote this for her, and I think the fact that Sean Baker's been making independent movies for 25 years, it finally shows a little bit of a shift in the Oscar voting. Number one, they're going a little bit more for independence. Number two, they're appreciating somebody that's been in the industry a long time. And number three, a fresh face on the scene.
Yeah, and also a wider conversation about how this film
changes the way sex workers are depicted in the industry as well. Some happy, saying that it captures those nuances. Mm-hmm. Others saying it doesn't move past the stereotypes. Where do you stand?
Well, I mean, stereotypes exist for a reason, because sometimes they seem to partake in the truth. And I think that I haven't been a sex worker, and I don't know that many, but I think it rings true that there are people, there are women generally, that are doing a job that we often look at and think, you know, that's not a job, that's something else. But I think it does show the camaraderie on the scene, and also the downfalls of it.
Mm. Others, though, say, actually, this isn't even about the sex worker industry. This is about class. And in that way, comparisons being made to pretty women.
Yes, it is. It is also about class. It's about money, because everything in America is pretty much based on that. Maybe everything in the world. Who knows? It is also about a love affair of a woman who wants to survive, and what she has to do to survive, and also what you can believe when it comes to love or not love. Is it infatuation? Is it something else? Is this marriage a way to get out of her job?
Well, let's talk about some of the other moments from last night. There was that payback kiss.
Yes, okay. about 22 years ago, when Adrian Brody won for the Pianist, I get this wrong every time, he won Best Actor Oscar for that, he planted a big heavy duty behind the hand kiss on Halle Berry, who was there as well. And this was on stage, you know, on camera. And she didn't give him permission to do that. And in later interviews, she was saying, you know, what the heck was that? And so last night, with permission from Adrian Brody's girlfriend, she did a little payback. Granted, it wasn't with a hand behind the head, but she got her revenge.
Because the Oscars is not just about the movies, it's about what happens on the night as well.
Very much so. I mean, there were billions of people tuned in. I mean, they could have tuned in anyway. It was available in virtually every country, the program last night.
Going back to the movies, though,
yes.
We're going to focus on the movies. We also had success for Zoe Saldana as well.
That was wonderful. That was wonderful. She also ran for the Critics' Circle. She was really the lead for a controversial film. Now, this film won, was given 13 nominations, and then the lead actress, some unfortunate tweets appeared, and basically they were knocked out of really participating in the promotion of the film. So Zoe became the face of this very audacious film. I saw it at Cannes, and it's not for everybody, but it's singing and dancing. It's the story of a Russian drug cartel man who wants to become a woman. And it's a musical. So you think, wow. But Zoe Saldana, amazing, a great performance, and a wonderful speech.
Also, lots of attention who was there and who wasn't there. And one person who was not in attendance was Suhaila Golestani. Tell us about that.
Yes, yes. Now, Suhaila Golestani was the star, or one of the supporting, well, yeah, star of The Seed of the Sacred Fig, which was nominated for Best International Film. It's no longer Best Film in English language, it's Best International Film. The film did not win, but she was unable to attend anyway, because she's actually being held, she'd been held in prison, actually. This is not the first time for her, but she's waiting punishment, apparently. Maybe 74 lashes. So she's accused for spreading corruption on Earth and propaganda against the regime. It runs a revolutionary court. So the fact that this film, even though it didn't win, it was nominated, it highlights what's going on in Iran. And let's just hope that this illuminates her case.
Indeed. Let us end on a positive, though. Fashion highlights for you.
Demi Moore was ready to win. She looked absolutely amazing, and everybody looked great. I have to say, it was nice to see. Well, there's a presentation of Whoopi Goldberg and Oprah Winfrey, and Oprah was wearing a tuxedo, and Whoopi, who always dresses in men's clothing, had on this beautiful gown. It was really quite something to see. But it was a great night. And if you can watch it recorded, please do.
Yes, highlights on the BBC website. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your highlights for us. That is the film journalist Karen Krizanovich with all things Oscars. Now let's move on to some news from the technology world. The UK data watchdog has launched what it calls a major investigation into TikTok's use of children's personal information. The Information Commissioner's Office, the ICO, will inspect the way in which the social media platform uses the data of 13 to 17-year-olds to recommend further content to them. Zoe Kleinman is the BBC's technology editor and Caitlin Ruger is Associate Professor Director of Digital Humanities at University College London. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Zoe, I will start with you. First of all, why is TikTok being called out specifically for this and what are those key concerns?
So the Information Commissioner's Office has said it's not particularly picking on TikTok, that was the word it used, but it's chosen it because it's a platform that has a lot of growth, particularly among younger users, and it has market dominance. And it says what it wants to do is to make sure that it's complying with two things that fall under the ICO's remit. One is the UK's data protection law, and the second is this thing called the Children's Code. And under the Children's Code, there are these design standards that are supposed to be built into all platforms where children are frequent, and they are designed to minimise the amount of data that's collected on children and also how it's stored and processed. Regarding TikTok, what the ICO says it wants to check is how it's using their activity online, so the videos they're watching, what they're commenting on, what they're liking, in order to serve them up more content. We know that's how all social networks operate, and also whether that is in the process either trying to get them to stay on the site for too long or serving them up content that might be harmful to them.
And when you say too long, what are we talking about?
I think that's a really difficult thing to define, isn't it? We know that TikTok says it's imposed a 60-minute default screen time limit on TikTok for children. So it doesn't let children stay on it for longer than an hour. Now, if you talk to parents, I have to say that there aren't many parents who tell me they seem to be very aware of that. But but that tool is in place. The ICO hasn't actually laid out exactly what that limit should be. But the thing is that this is how these platforms make money. You know, the longer you're on the site, the more likely you are to be exposed to ads. And that is how they operate. And that is why you don't have to pay to use it. Or indeed, some other platforms will offer you a subscription where you can pay instead of seeing adverts.
And you mentioned that time limitation tool. My question there is really, how do they monitor how long you've been on? Is it all in one chunk? Can you do multiple chunks of an hour? But I guess we're all still understanding these scenarios as well. We've spoken a lot about TikTok, but I imagine these concerns apply to a range of platforms.
I think they do. And actually, there are three investigations that the ICO has launched today. Two of the others are into platforms Reddit, which is a sort of massive, massive internet chat forum, and Imgur, which is an image-based social network. It says it wants to make sure that they're both using age verification effectively to ensure that children using those platforms aren't exposed to content that's not suitable for them. Now, this is a tricky one for Reddit, actually, because it would describe itself as highly private by default. It doesn't really collect any data on anyone. So ironically, it finds itself in a situation where it's going to have to collect more data in order to comply with some of the privacy issues that this is throwing up. And I have to say that TikTok says its recommender systems are designed to operate under strict and comprehensive measures to protect the privacy and safety of teens. And it also says that there are some themes, like, for example, adults smoking tobacco, that are routinely blocked from teens' feeds, and it also monitors its live streams. And Reddit says that 95% of its UK users, it believes, are adults. So it doesn't think that that there are very many children on its site at all. But of course, this is what the ICO wants to find out. And I think we need to stress that they're not accusing any of these companies of breaching any laws. They're investigating whether or not they have at this stage.
Stay with us, Zoe. Let me bring Caitlin into our conversation. Caitlin, help us understand how these companies use these algorithms to get the data they are seeking.
Thank you. So I think it's important to emphasize what Zoe said, which is we don't pay for these services, right? We don't have the same consumer protections that we do on most of other things we consume, like food, okay, like the cars we drive, like the medication we take. And that's because we aren't really the consumers here. We're the product. Or rather, our time and our attention is the product which is being sold to advertisers. And this is a construct called the attention economy, through which social media companies need to prove to advertisers that they can hold our attention. And the problem with this, and what my research has looked at specifically on TikTok with young people, is that often the things that hold our attention are things like harm and misinformation, because quite frankly, often misinformation is more attention-grabbing than truth. And so for young people, and we're particularly worried about this with young people because they can be more vulnerable, but for all of us, this can be the case. It is the things that hook into our insecurities or the things that can elicit strong responses that can be more attention grabbing. And this, it's through this process and this construct that we see harm being prioritized, that we see things like self-harm, body dysmorphia, and misogyny for boys prioritized.
Interesting what you say, lots to unpick in that. You say that because this is an attention economy, that we don't benefit from the same protections as we might with other consumer products. But when it comes to children, surely there are universal protections that need to be kept in mind. How do they factor into this conversation?
Absolutely. I think that we should, that we need to redefine this entire structure. And I think, you know, moments like today are really important in bringing awareness to the way in which these structures function. I think that we all need to be more informed about it, because if we're more informed about it as a community, we can start to push back and say, we're not comfortable with this economy. We're not comfortable for our eyeballs or our children's eyeballs being glued to screens at any cost. We know that there are addictive processes being used here. We know that children's online behaviors, how long they linger on certain things, is collected and used in order to keep them there longer and longer and longer. And I think it's excellent that we're starting to push back and question whether we're happy with this type of an economy.
Zoe, turning back to you, what powers are in place to ensure that, depending on the findings of these various investigations, that TikTok complies?
So it's important to say that the ICO doesn't manage the Online Safety Act, which we also have here in the UK, and which is specifically designed to protect children. What its remit is the data protection side of things. And the powers that it has under regulating that include fines for non-compliance, but they're all subject to appeal. So actually, it's already issued TikTok with a fine of £12.7 million for misusing children's data. That was issued in 2023 and is still undergoing appeal. So it can be a long process if indeed they do find that there's been a breach of the law. And the other thing to say is these investigations take ages. You know, we're not going to get the results of this tomorrow or anytime soon. It's going to take a long time. They're very thorough. They're very painstaking. It does take a long, long time for these cogs to turn. So I think if people are hoping that there's going to be some sort of swift process here and swift justice if required, I'm afraid that's not the case.
And have we heard from TikTok on this specific concern?
Well, yes, they are confident that their recommender systems are operating in the way that they're supposed to. And they say they've worked with the ICO. They are prepared to work within the Online Safety Act as well. And they think that they're confident that their design measures are protecting the privacy and safety of teens. That's what they say.
A very quick question to you, Caitlin, just before I let you go. There'll be parents listening to this who are concerned. And as Zoe rightly highlights, these investigations can take a very long time and we may not feel any difference for a significant amount of time. What do you say to parents who are concerned about what is popping up on their children's TikTok feeds and how long they're spending on these platforms?
So one thing is to discuss these issues with kids, to talk about the way in which these processes are addictive. The other thing is, these are hyper, hyper personal feeds. And I think it's important that I call it a walkthrough methodology, that we actually open up our feeds, all of us, not just our children, with each other and do a walkthrough of a normal period of usage so that we're actually sharing what we're seeing, so that we do some bit of sense checking. And then you can actually make a decision. You can decide what types of content you do want to see and what types you don't. And you can start to game your algorithm. You can start to actively look for things that you want to see and move quickly past things that you don't. Don't linger on it. Don't comment on it. So that you're actually starting to show your algorithm and take control of it as an active participant instead of a passive user.
Really interesting. Thank you for your time, Caitlin Regier and the BBC's Zoe Kleinman. Next, staying with health, trauma can be a major barrier to seeking medical care. According to a new survey from Health Watch England, women experience trauma more than men, and nearly one in five respondents who have experienced trauma say they often or fairly often avoid health services. Now, they are calling on the NHS to adopt pocket-sized trauma cards for patients to show during appointments, and this is following a successful pilot in Essex. Louise Ansari is Chief Executive of Health Watch England, the patient's champion, and Laura, not her real name, is a survivor of sexual trauma and a sessional counsellor for CARA, the Centre for Action on Rape and Abuse. They both join me now. Thank you both for your time. Louise, let me start with you. Definitions are important. What do we mean by trauma?
Yes, morning, Krupa. So trauma is basically defined as a really distressing event that it's so extreme or intense it kind of is overwhelming for people. People can't cope, often they're very anxious, often can't sleep. And the kinds of traumatic event that people have raised with us are things like accidents, birth trauma, acts of violence, sexual abuse.
How does the trauma that you highlight there, how do these examples impact the way people engage with medical care?
Yes, so obviously this, you know, the pilot from Healthwatch Essex was just fantastic. We wanted to understand the extent of trauma across England. So we did a really big survey, 3,500 people. Over half, so actually nearly 60% of people said they'd suffered some kind of trauma. And of those, around about a fifth, 18% said they actually avoided checkups because they found them quite triggering. They set off memories about their previous trauma.
So significant data there. Laura, let me bring you in. As a survivor of trauma, how has trauma impacted the way you engage with healthcare services?
Good morning. I think as a survivor that's had professional support and has developed good coping strategies, I think people think that we cope really well in everyday life. But I'm extremely triggered by health appointments, especially things like cervical screening and any other intimate exam. You start to feel really vulnerable. Also, it can definitely trigger your trauma symptoms of avoidance, flashbacks, numbing, dissociation. So I've had appointments where I haven't heard my name being called because I'm starting to sort of shut down. You can get the NHS can be frustrated with you if you try, without explaining your actual trauma, but try and explain some of the things that you need to help you. You know, that's been really difficult in the past. So, you know, that having a trauma card is going to be extremely helpful, but also having the funding for people that have had trauma, especially my example for women who had sexual violence, the funding there needs to be really robust.
You share some really powerful examples there. Not hearing your name being called when you're waiting in that waiting room, it almost feels like you're disempowered. You're voiceless in those situations.
Yeah, I think anyone that is vulnerable feels that they're not heard, they're not seen, they don't matter. But there is a trauma symptom where you dissociate, where you start to shut down, and the world doesn't really exist in the same way for you. It's a sort of massive defence mechanism that we can have as trauma survivors.
Tell us about your knee operation.
Well, about 12 years ago, I broke my leg quite badly, and I was really triggered by the thought that I'd had to have a general anaesthetic. The thought of being unconscious and around people that I didn't know was incredibly triggering. And I tried to explain to the consultant that I really didn't want a general anaesthetic. And he felt it was a, he thought that my concern was about scarring. And I tried to explain that it wasn't. In the end, I had to explain in some detail what had happened. And then he was incredibly supportive. And I had an epidural and I was able to have my leg plated and pinned. But there was one time during that conversation where I thought, could I live with a limp? Do I really need to have this done? And that's the kind of extremes that trauma yes. survivors have to live with.
The mind spirals. Louise, you mentioned the trial in Essex there. Tell us how that fared and really what you're seeking here. How would these trauma cards work?
Yes, so Healthwatch Essex did this fantastic trial. They actually handed out around about 15,000 of these trauma cards, and basically they're sort of, you know, credit card-sized cards that you can hand over to a healthcare professional, and you don't have to explain your trauma. There's a QR code on it that basically says, this is how, you know, I've had a traumatic event, and it links to resources for how healthcare professionals can support people using the principles of trauma-informed care, you know, providing a safe environment, empowering people, having humility. And, you know, just as Laura, incredibly good of Laura to, you know, to talk on air about her experience, you basically don't have to go through that awful explaining process, which in itself can be quite distressing.
And
so what we're looking
yeah.
for is for that to be rolled out.
So I've got a question about the practicalities of this. Even though they're kind of pocket-sized trauma cards, you've got this QR code on the back. That is then scanned. And then I imagine a lot of notes come up on the healthcare worker's screen explaining what has happened to the individual. That would take time. And we know often in healthcare appointments, there isn't much time. There are people waiting in the waiting room. How does this fare in terms of logistics?
I mean, so the QR code links to some resources for the healthcare professionals that basically say, this person's had a trauma, this is how to support the person. And actually, one of the things that really does need to happen is trauma-informed care just needs to become the norm as part of personalised care for all healthcare professionals when they're talking to people. So it doesn't necessarily take a long time. You know, it should be a quick thing. You know how you scan QR codes with your phone, it takes just a few seconds. So the more personalised the care is, the more likely people are to actually go and get it. I mean, if you think about trauma having this kind of double health impact, basically, the psychological impact of the first trauma itself, and then the potential tail of that with further impacts on physical and mental health if people are avoiding going for appointments. So anything that helps people go for appointments and helps healthcare professionals treat them is a really good thing.
Laura, you took part in this trial. How helpful was it for you?
Incredibly helpful. As I explained before, I can feel quite vulnerable in sort of NHS intimate exams, and I used one of these cards. It was a game changer. The staff, the lady that I saw, was really supportive and asked me, was there anything in particular that I needed? And that's something that just doesn't happen normally when you go for appointments. You know, I can see that how much this is going to help survivors of trauma. Just incredible.
Louise, we know with the NHS, unfortunately, these days, everything comes down to money and resources. What has been the response from the NHS to rolling this out?
We've had really positive conversations with NHS England. This is an extremely low-cost potential solution to a really widespread problem. You know, it doesn't mean more staff, it doesn't mean huge amounts of infrastructure, and actually in the long term, after potentially a national pilot, it could be moved on to the NHS app. So it isn't a huge ask, but it could mean a great deal to really large numbers of people who could be supported better with their care.
Louise Ansari, Chief Executive of Healthwatch England, and Laura, not her real name, a survivor of sexual trauma. Thank you for sharing your powerful account with us, and a sessional counsellor for the Centre for Action on Rape and Abuse. Thank you for your time. I should say that if you...
Hi, I'm Namulanta Kombo, here to tell you that my podcast, Dear Daughter, is back. And this time, I'm joined by an all-star lineup of guests, each with some sage life advice and a letter for their daughter.
every mother has a letter in her head for their daughter. So it's really nice that that's being like expressed out loud.
That's Dear Daughter Stars from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
Have been impacted by anything you've heard today, please go to the BBC Action Line where you can find links to support. Now, what did people do before the internet if they thought they might be gay or lesbian and needed advice? Well, we're going to spend some time now talking about telephone lines that were once peppered around the country that offered essential support, where people could go to learn about pubs that were gay-friendly or connect with house shares, offer counsel on coming out, or simply provide a friendly listening ear. Writer Elizabeth Levette discovered the logbooks of calls made to one of these lines and imagines the callers and their conversations to tell the history of these helplines in her new book, Thank You for Calling the Lesbian Line. She joins me now along with Lisa Power, historian, social activist and longtime Lesbian Line volunteer from 1979 and 1994. Good to have you both with us. Elizabeth, I will start with you. What inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, I mean, really, I found this logbook in an archive and the archivist very offhandedly was like, oh, we've got this logbook from a lesbian line. And I thought, what's that? I've never heard of a lesbian line. And as soon as I found it, I just knew it was this incredible treasure trove of women's stories. They were just handwritten accounts from the women who worked on these lesbian lines of the different kind of calls that they made. And it was just such an exciting discovery to find that I just had to share their stories.
Yes, and you share them from the 1990s. But Lisa, you volunteered on these advice lines for 15 years during an earlier period. What sort of calls would you get and what advice and support could you offer?
Well, I was on Lesbian and Gay Switchboard, which was 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And honestly, we got every kind of call. You have to remember, there was no internet in those days. So we were the major source of information on where people could go. So we did a lot of information calls, but also a hell of a lot of support calls because lesbians and gay men were not nearly as visible then as they are now. And for lesbians particularly, there were very few role models. To hear the voice of another lesbian down the phone line was life-changing for many women.
It's interesting you talk about the context there and the time at which you were operating. That would have come with its own challenges for you, because what kind of training were you offered, if any?
Well, certainly the Lesbian and Gay Switchboard, we had a very rigorous training program, but you have to remember there were many of these lesbian lines across the country. And for many of them, they were just very happy to get volunteers. And the level of training varied dramatically. We certainly thought it was very important that there was emotional support for people who'd taken difficult calls, because you would get calls from people who were thinking about suicide, people who'd been thrown out of home, many people who were terrified. I mean, women in particular calling at 2 or 3 in the morning, very quietly, because their husband and kids were upstairs. And they knew that if their husband found out that they were a lesbian or just even attracted to another woman, that in any divorce proceedings, they would lose custody and indeed any access to their kids almost automatically.
So moving what you share there, Lisa. And Elizabeth, you try and capture some of these stories in your book in both a kind of mashup of fiction and non-fiction. Really interesting way of telling the story. Why did you choose this approach?
Yeah, I really wanted to share the stories of these women, but also to acknowledge that, you know, these calls were confidential that they made to the lesbian lines. They never would have expected them to be shared. And also, I just couldn't trace them even if I wanted to. The callers were often anonymous. They often just rang once. They maybe never left their name or just the first name. So there was no way that I could kind of track the women down either. And I really wanted to be able to tell an honest story about the real everyday lives of lesbians, but in a way that didn't reveal their true stories. So or that their real stories. So what I did was, yeah, use fiction to kind of bridge that gap. And, you know, these kind of combined them with my own research that I'd done, or speaking to people like Lisa who had more stories to share. And this meant that I could tell a variety of all the different kind of calls, but in a way that also felt universal to lesbian experience at that time as well.
Which stood out for you?
There's one call in particular that I really love. It's from two teenage girls. They're quite young. They're at school. And they're calling the lesbian line, not for the reason that you might think, because they're not sure if they're lesbians. They're very certain that they're lesbians. But they're being bullied at school because one of them has told another girl that they fancy them and they don't know what to do about it. They've spoken to their teacher and their teacher's advice was to go to the police, which they didn't want to do. And so they call a lesbian line to get some support. And I think, you know, the important context here for that story is that it's under Section 28. So this is the mid-90s. For listeners that maybe don't know, Section 28 was a local government act that prevented local authorities from promoting homosexuality as a pretended family relationship, was the wording that they used. And this effectively meant that schools and libraries just didn't discuss homosexuality in any way. There was, you know, no conversation around LGBT lives in schools. It was really censored. And so it really just, I think, reveals the way that the lesbian lines could be this form of support and community work and network for lesbians when there just wasn't that other support elsewhere. And also just being this really visible, living example to these young girls that you could be a lesbian and it was going to be okay, you could be happy. So yeah, that's one of my favourite calls, I think, that I write about.
What I'm hearing from you both is that the people on the other end of this phone line, these strangers who these women are talking to, played a crucial role, often life-saving, I imagine, in many ways. Lisa, how did you come to get involved in it?
I entirely accidentally, a friend was going along for an interview to join Switchboard, and I went along too as a kind of, you know, bit of a support, ended up being interviewed and being accepted. And it was a massive education for me. I mean, being on these lines allowed you to talk with people who you would never have met in ordinary everyday life, and especially for people like me, a bit of an activist, a bit cut off from the reality of life for many less open lesbians at that time, to hear those women and speak with those women made me remember that not everybody was as privileged as me, and it was terrific to be able to help people, but also to be able to learn while I was doing that.
That leads me to a question to you, Elizabeth. There was a phrase you used in your book that stayed with me. You said that lesbian history is a hidden history. Explain that to us.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I also grew up under Section 28. I come, like most lesbians, from a straight family. Our lesbian history isn't an easy inheritance for us. And, you know, I came out later in life when I was 28. And to find my lesbian history, it took a lot of hard work. It's really scattered. It's in archives, it's maybe an offhand mention in a museum caption somewhere. It might be in an older generation that you can't access through your community. You know, we really have to work hard to find our lesbian history. And what I wanted to do with this book was just to bring all of that learning and excitement that I had discovered along the way when I was coming out and kind of help share that for other people and for it to be a, you know, another kind of step along the way of people being able to discover their lesbian stories and lesbian lives, really. There's so many.
It's incredible. Just reading the way you've put the archive together in these records, just how much you can capture, how much history you can capture from one snippet of a conversation. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think just I found it so relatable as well. Yeah. I think that was what was so interesting to me, that these are stories from 30 years ago. But they're at risk of being forgotten as well. You know, yeah. This is living history. You can talk to people like Lisa that worked on these lines. But if you speak to someone younger than me, they won't know about them. And I think it just gives you such a great cross-section, I think, of just ordinary lives that are so hard to find, of kind of what was happening at that time.
We've had this message in from a listener. On speaking to strangers down the line, I used an employee support line my work provided during the early months of the pandemic to ask for guidance I could give to a housemate who was having a mental health crisis at the time. In the end, I broke down in tears on the call and realised I needed support too. It was the first time, it was the first person, rather, I talked to outside of that bubble in months. And just speaking to that stranger was incredibly cathartic. I still think about that call. Thank you for your message. Lisa, do you think there's still a role for such telephone helplines to play?
I think they're still incredibly important. And Switchboard LGBT, as it is now, is still going. But of course, in the modern era, we're also talking about instant messages. We're talking about texts and other things on top of phone calls. I mean, I think it's really important to be able to contact somebody for the first time that you can actually say, I think I might be a lesbian. And not just be told where to go or whatever, but just to have that person say, you know, welcome to the family.
Yeah. And when you look back on your role, How do you think it's contributed to the larger LGBTQ plus rights movement? And you know, going forward, what role could it still have?
I think that the heart of getting people to understand that we should be equal to everybody else and that we are the same as everybody else is for people to be able to talk, to be open. And I think that the major role that these helplines play is in supporting people to be themselves, to let their family and friends know who they are and to live their full life, to not have to hide. I mean, in the 80s, it was much more 80s and 90s. It was much more scary in that we didn't have any kind of legal protection at all. But for some of us, things are heading in a bad direction again at the moment. And I think this kind of support line is probably more needed now than it has been in a couple of decades.
Elizabeth, you write in your book that these kind of logbooks, these kind of calls are an example of quiet activism. Mm. Again, that stood out to me. What do you hope readers will take away from Thank You for Calling the Lesbian Line?
Yeah, I think it is just that it is everyday activism, that it is, you know, this was difficult work that these women did. They were often in a basement room, just two of them waiting for the phone to call. It was unglamorous, but they should be celebrated for that work. And, you know, they weren't perfect. They made mistakes. They would forget to stand up for their shift or plug in the answer machine and other things. But anybody can get involved in their local community work and they can really make a difference. You know, this is one-to-one. You can make a difference to someone's life just by listening.
Thank you so much for your time, Lisa Power and Elizabeth Levett on her new book. Thank You for Calling the Lesbian Line by Elizabeth Levett is out now. Thank you for your various messages that you have been sending in. Chris says, I am a survivor of sexual trauma and also autistic, so I find all sorts of appointments difficult, even with a support worker accompanying me. I carry a card for autism, but I am still required to suffer and endure waiting rooms so that I am shut down by the time I get to my appointment. I have never considered that my trauma might be feeding into this. Well, thank you for sharing that, Chris. We do appreciate this. And on our conversation about TikTok and concerns there, Jane says, I work in a school where children as young as 8 have TikTok and Snapchat accounts, which both have lower age limits of 13. How can they say they are monitoring whether children have access to material which is unsuitable when many of their child subscribers are already underage? This will not give them accurate information about their subscribers. It's so important to speak to not just parents, but teachers as well. Thank you for your message. Do keep your messages coming in. It's at BBC Women's Hour over on social media. Now, last Tuesday, the Women's Hour studio was graced by two acting legends, Olivia Award winners Celia Imrie and Tamsin Craig, joined Newland McGovern to discuss their new play, Backstroke, currently on at the Donmar in London, in which they play mother and daughter. When Newland asked them about frustration and the diffusing power of humour, Celia was reminded of her relationship with her own mother.
I've always talked about the kind of the biological response, that laughing and crying are very similar muscular responses. Mm. And so, you know, if you're close to that kind of the trauma of crying, of sobbing, it's almost indistinguishable at times with panicked laughing. So I think that they are very easy bedfellows. And I mean, you can't just cry all night long.
You've got to have a laugh.
Shakespeare knows, you know, switch it up, you know, awful bit, then have a laugh. But it struck me very much because a lot of the audience will possibly have gone through losing their mother or having lost their mother. And it struck me very much that I personally wish that I hadn't lost my temper with my mother maybe once, twice. I wish I could have those days back, you know, when she was being cantankerous or something. And she wasn't. She was wonderful. But I think if there's anything this play might remind people of, it's make the most of them while you've got them. Because actually nothing prepares you for your mother dying. It's colossal.
Profound.
Yes. Mm. And so don't regret any of the moments. But my goodness, Bo is tested to the limit. I mean, you know.
Mm-hmm. One of the very moving scenes, there are many, is, this is it a spoiler alert if I talk about a funeral scene?
I wonder.
But a list of small but oh so significant things that her mother taught her. The one that really stayed with me after way is the very best way to eat an orange, but also how to knit, darn, crochet. I wonder, Celia, as you talk about your mother, is there one thing that comes to the mind as Beau is reading out this list about your own experience?
My favourite bit of the list, and remember, I'm dead at the time, but I listened to it very carefully and very moved about being perpetually late, but being then the room being enchanted
the eventual
by your
entrance.
Eventual entrance.
Well done. That, you remembered that beautifully. I don't remember it because I've got it written down in a speech at the funeral.
That's my favourite.
Yes.
That's my favourite.
You know, it's something I aspire to.
And certainly was true of my darling mother.
That was Celia Imrie and Tamsin Gregg talking to Nuala. And if you'd like to hear the full interview, it's the Woman's Hour episode from the 25th of February. Now, Twiggy turned the modelling world upside down with her teenage androgynous style, big round eyes, bold eyelashes and pixie haircut. She became a defining figure and fashion icon of the swinging 60s. She was the girl next door who went on to be considered one of the world's first supermodels and then came a successful career in acting and singing, earning two Golden Globes and a Tony nomination. She designed fashion ranges, appeared as a judge on America's Next Top Model and was awarded a damehood for her services to fashion, arts and charity. Now a new documentary, Twiggy, directed by Sadie Frost, is out in cinemas from Friday, and Twiggy joins me now. Welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks for doing this. Now, such a rich account from your life shared in this docufilm. How does it feel to watch all the footage of yourself from over the decades?
It's a mixture of emotions. I hadn't, because Sadie Frost obviously directed it and I did some interviews for it, but she obviously got together all the clips, and there's lots of clips from the 60s. So when I went in to see the first cut of it, it was very emotional, you know, seeing clips of my mum and dad who are not around anymore, and me very much younger, and my daughter very much younger, and obviously it goes through my whole life. So there's happy moments and there's sad moments like any life. So I cried through a lot of it.
Yeah,
but
I can imagine.
I think Sadie's done an amazing job to put it all together.
Yes, and as you rightly highlighted, it takes us back to those early days, those tender days, because you were so young, Twiggy. I mean, you were young, but yet you were being told things like you're too short, you're too thin. And really, you have the Daily Express to thank for your fame in those early days,
making you
the face of 1966. But you were just 16 years old. That's a lot to take on at such a tender age.
I know. I mean, I owe a lot to Deirdre McSharry, who was the journalist who wrote that headline, Twiggy, the face of 66, because she took a punt on it, really, because I didn't, as you know, I didn't look like the models of the day. So what happened to me on paper shouldn't have happened, but it did, and I'm very glad it did.
Yeah, that was your path. Let's talk about your style, because just 16, but oh my goodness, you took the fashion world by storm with those statement big eyelashes. First of all, tell us how you achieved that, and was that your style? Was that the Twiggy style?
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, like most teenage girls, I played with makeup. I went to a grammar school, so we weren't allowed makeup in the week, but at weekends my friends and I would play with makeup like all teenage girls probably still do. And I had a rag doll in my bedroom and she had those spiky eyelashes under her eyes, so I was playing around putting false eyelashes on the top, drawing the ones underneath, and it kind of evolved. It was my, because in when I started modeling, we would do our own makeup. I mean, I think Joanna Lumley talks about having to arrive at the studio ready, made up. We didn't have makeup artists like they do today. So I did that myself. And I was a mod before the whole thing happened to me. So I was very into clothes. I used to make all my own clothes. And obviously the mini skirt had just hit. And that kind of became one of my looks.
Yes, and am I right in thinking it was three pairs of false eyelashes?
It was three pairs. Yes.
that's quite something. You were, in many ways, Twiggy, considered the first model that people could relate to. I mean, would you put that down to what you've spoken quite openly about, your working class roots?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, you've got to remember, if I'd have gone to a model agency then in 1966, they wouldn't have taken me because I was, on their books, too small and too slim. So, you know, what happened to me, as I said, shouldn't have happened. And I think most models in those days came from either upper-class families or middle-class families. And I came from a very happy family, but a working-class family. And so it hadn't even gone into my mindset to try and become a model because that didn't happen to girls like me. And I hope the film will show young girls out there, young boys out there, that actually you can be different, you can be unique, and you should just, you know, go for your dreams, really, if you have the chance.
If modelling wasn't on your radar because you thought it was just off limits, it doesn't happen to girls like me, what was on your radar? What was the plan?
I was planning to try and get into art school and do fashion and design, actually, which in later years I ended up doing with various companies because I still love it. I still make clothes. I love it. It's my hobby.
Yeah. It's more than a hobby. It's more than a hobby, isn't it? You've made a name for yourself. Look, growing up in Northwest London, we do also see footage of your parents, whom you're very close to. Again, you've spoken very openly about that. Your mum was a factory worker. Your dad was a master carpenter. You've also spoken about your mum being quite depressed at times, but at the time it wasn't something you were aware of.
Not really, because I was the youngest of three sisters. So my elder sister was 15 years older than me. So she almost became like a second mum to me. And mum was fine for a lot of the time. And then she'd have a low and she'd go to hospital and ended up having electric shock treatment. But, you know, I was kind of protected by my wonderful dad, who was amazing, and my sisters. And it wasn't until I became an adult that I realized, you know, they'd just say, oh, mum's not very well. And I used to like going to see her in hospital because my dad would take her grapes and I'd get to eat them.
How did they reflect on your fame at such a tender age? I know, and we are going to speak about Justin at the time, who was your partner at the time, your manager and boyfriend. But, you know, you'd come under the umbrella of your parents and your older sisters, and suddenly you're rising mountains and climbing to such heights.
Yeah, I mean, it was weird because it all happened so quickly. Yeah. You know, 1 minute I was at school, next went, you know, 2 months later I was in Paris doing the French collections, and then 9 months later I was in New York, which is the thing that really changed my life, going to America, because Diana Vreeland, who was the editress of American Vogue, had read about me, and she took me over to New York. And that's when it kind of, you know, the Beatles had gone in about 3 or 4 years before me, and I went in 1967. So I was kind of part of the British invasion.
Yes.
And when I arrived in New York City, you know, there were girls at the airport with banners with my name. I mean, it was really peculiar for me. I didn't expect that. And all the press were there. And I remember the first journalist say, you know, welcome, Twiggy. What do you think of New York? And I said, well, I've only just landed. All I've seen is the runway.
And with you by your side.
It was bizarre.
And with you by your side was your manager, who then became your boyfriend, Justin de Villeneuve. He was 25 at the time. You were obviously just 16. How do you look back on that relationship and travelling the world together now?
Well, obviously he protected me. You know, all this that came out later about what models and actresses go through didn't happen to me, because I had, if he wasn't around, my part of the deal of me leaving school, my dad said, you've got to have a chaperone.
Yeah.
So if Justin wasn't there, my dad was there, or my mum was there. So I was completely protected as a young girl. So I didn't know any of that happened. I was quite green, really. And, you know, and it wasn't, you know, and then suddenly I met the most wonderful man called Ken Russell, who was going to cast me in a film that didn't happen. We became very good friends, him and his wife. And a year later, he cast me in The Boyfriend, which completely changed my life.
Yeah.
When I started filming that, it was like going, for me, it was like going into the secret garden. And it was like, oh my, and that's why I changed career, because it opened up all new doors of doing a TV series, having a record contract. But I hadn't planned to do that. But then I hadn't planned to model. So, you know, I was given the opportunities, and hopefully I grabbed them as strongly as I could. Same as going on Broadway. I mean, who would have thought I'd have ended up on Broadway doing a big Broadway show? Not me.
Twiggy, you say you were green when you headed out there, but actually what I saw in some of that documentary was a strong and feisty young girl. There is this one instance which really stood out where you interact with a young Woody Allen who asks you what your views are on serious matters and specifically who your favourite philosopher is. And your reply was a masterful one. Tell us about that.
Well, really, you've got to go and see the film to get the whole the whole impact of it. But it was extraordinary. And looking at it now, I just think it was quite a mean thing to do to a young, innocent girl that I was. I certainly wouldn't do that to a young newcomer. But I think when he started throwing those questions at me, my main feeling was embarrassment because I couldn't answer them. And then I wanted desperately for him to help me, and that's why I was kind of pleading with him, will you tell me yours, what were their names? And he couldn't come up with it either.
It was brilliant. But also, you have also had male interviewers asking you at that time considerably about your weight, commenting on you being flat-chested, being blamed for encouraging girls not to eat. How do you reflect on that now?
Well, I don't think they get away with it now, would they? It was kind of part of the norm. I mean, again, Joanna Lumley is brilliant in the piece she talks about of how most models were treated in that day, which I found amazing because that didn't really happen to me. Although, again, you do hear these photographers saying some extraordinary things. But on the other hand, I did work with some extraordinary, wonderful photographers who were complete gentlemen, people like Richard Avedon, Barry Latigan, who took my first photograph, Melvin Sikorski. They were all amazing to me and changed my life.
Laurence is listening and says, check out Twiggy duetting with the late Tim Hardin singing The Lady Came from Baltimore, available on YouTube. A lot of people are still unaware that Twiggy possessed a fine singing voice. And Twiggy, you did go on to win awards for acting and music. There's this lovely scene in the documentary where you are singing a duet with Bing Crosby. What was that like?
Amazing. A bit scary because, and that's just going back a bit, this is why I thank Sadie so much, because I think a lot of people, when you say my name, they just think of the 60s, and I've done many, many, many more things. And that's why it's lovely that Sadie has covered the whole piece of my life. And singing with Bing was magical and very, very scary because we had to sing it live because he refused to do things to playback, quite rightly. So that little clip of us from his Christmas show that year was the two of us singing live, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was probably one of his last performances because after the recording of that show, he went off to Spain to play golf, which was his passion, and he had a massive heart attack and he died. So I think David Bowie was on that show with me, and I think we were the last two people to sing with Bing.
Yeah. Listen, Twiggy, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. There is so much more we wanted to talk to you about, but alas, we have run out of time. Your plans now, because I know that there is no plan to retire and that you're spending lots of time with your grandkids as well. But an absolute pleasure having you on, Twiggy. Thank you for joining us.
Can I just say I'm carrying on with my Tea with Twiggy podcast as well, if people want to listen.
Thank you for sharing that as well. That is Twiggy, and her documentary is out on Friday. That is it from this edition of Women's Hour. Thank you for your company, and do join me again tomorrow. Thanks for listening. There's plenty more from Women's Hour over at BBC Sounds.
This is Danny Robbins here, host of Uncanny, with some exciting news to share. The Uncannyverse is getting even bigger with a brand new Uncanny TV series on BBC Two and iPlayer, featuring some frankly terrifying cases that will make your hair stand on end. But then we will be taking an even deeper dive into these stories with Uncanny Postmortem, a new visualised podcast, straight afterwards on BBC Two, iPlayer, and right here as audio on BBC Sounds. Expect spine-tingling new twists and some chilling revelations. That is Uncanny Postmortem. Join me if you dare.
Hi, I'm Namulanta Kombo, here to tell you that my podcast, Dear Daughter, is back. And this time, I'm joined by an all-star lineup of guests, each with some sage life advice and a letter for their daughter.
Every mother has a letter in her head for their daughter. So it's really nice that that's being like expressed out loud.
That's Dear Daughter Stars from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.